Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Stuttered Kennedy. Chapter 3, Growing Up. A quote from Benjamin Pierce. When I had finished my business, passing from Stoddard through Hillsboro, I called at a log hut, and after a few words asked the farmer how he lived. As other farmers, "Where do you get your meat?" "In yonder brooks." "Where your meal?" "At Litchfield." I asked him if he would sell. He replied that he would. I told him to go along with me to a justice of the peace, and I would purchase his farm, which was about 50 acres. After the deed was executed, I continued my journey to Chelmsford, and the spring following, 1786, in company with a soldier, my companion in the army, I came to Hillsboro and took up my residence in the log hut I had lately purchased. Here I commenced cutting and clearing away the trees, lying on a blanket with my companion, and living as best we could. End quote. So does General Benjamin Pierce, veteran of the Revolutionary War, and an old friend of the Bakers, record in his quaint autobiography the founding of the family fortunes in New Hampshire. At the outbreak of the War of Revolution, he was working on his uncle's farm in Chelmsford, a little town not far from Concord, Massachusetts. And on the historic day of April 19, 1775, when the British marched out of Boston to take possession of the stores and arms at Concord, the news reached young Pierce as he was plowing in the field. "The British," shouted a passing horseman, "have fired on the Americans at Lexington and killed 8 men. Like so many others, young Benjamin did not hesitate a moment. "I stepped between the cattle," he writes, "dropped the chains from the plow, and without any further ceremony shouldered my uncle's fowling piece, swung the bullet pouch and powder horn, and hastened to the place where the first blood had been spilled. Next morning, I enlisted in Captain John Ford's company, which was stationed at Cambridge." The end of the war found him covered with honor, but destitute of money. So when he was solicited by one Colonel Stoddard to explore lands which he, Colonel Stoddard, owned in New Hampshire, he accepted gladly and went on his journey. It was on his way back from this expedition that he made the quick purchase just mentioned of a log hut and 50 acres of land in Hillsboro. In this same log hut, some 20 years later, in 1804, Franklin Pierce, the future President of the United States and lifelong friend of Albert Baker, was born. At that time, Benjamin Pierce was coming to be a man of consequence, not only in his little community, but in the state. In the year Franklin was born, the log hut was exchanged for a new and elegant home in Hillsboro Lower Village, and Benjamin Pierce began to take a vigorous part in state and national politics. His education had amounted to very little, what he could gather before he entered the army, by attending school from the age of 10 to 16 years, 3 weeks in each year. But he was a man of rugged, forceful personality, wise and generous. If his long years of soldiering had made him somewhat domineering, he was quick to see his own limitations and to acclaim the virtues of his fellows. Known throughout the countryside as Squire Pierce, he was a squire in every sense of the term as it had come to be used in New England. At the time when Mark Baker was beginning to wrestle with the religious problems of his youngest child, Benjamin Pierce, now a general, he had taken an active part in the War of 1812, was governor of New Hampshire. And when attending to his duties at Concord, he would often ride over of an evening to see Mark Baker at Bow. Bow was just a pleasant ride from Concord, and although there were in those days no telephones to escape from, Governor Pierce evidently found the Baker home at Bow a welcome retreat from official duties, and Mark Baker a congenial companion. Even after he had retired finally into private life, as he did in 1830, the general would often, on occasion, drive over from Hillsborough along the winding Contoocook River to visit his old friend. The two had much in common. Indeed, it is to be imagined that after Priest Burnham, there was no one Squire Baker loved to talk with more than Squire Pierce. The old general may not, and probably did not, share Mark's militant strength in religious matters, but when it came to denouncing a Federalist or maintaining the principle of states' rights, the two veterans went along together without a hitch. Mary seems to have been particularly interested in these visits, not only because grown-up conversation always had fascination for her as a child, but no doubt chiefly because, sooner or later, in the course of the visit, she would be sure to hear something about her much-loved brother, Albert, then, about 1832, at Dartmouth, and about the general's son, Franklin. Albert had been a guest several times at the Pierces, and between him and Franklin Pierce, just then establishing himself as a lawyer at Hillsborough, there early existed a very real bond of sympathy. Franklin was 6 years older than Albert, just about the right disparity in age to produce devotion on one side and lively interest on the other. And there can be no doubt that when Albert returned home at vacation time, he brought back with him glowing tales of his friend and of the household at Hillsborough. Mary, of course, would be all ears. The Pierce family, 5 boys and 3 girls, was, as a whole, some 5 or 6 years ahead of the Baker family. The youngest child was 9 years old when Mary was born. To a little girl of 12 or 13, they represented attainment in the fullest sense of the word. And Albert, so definitely on his way as to be at Dartmouth, gained much reflected glory to Mary's mind in having Franklin for a friend. Almost from the first, Mary's education seems to have presented a problem. At the usual age, he began to go, with her brothers and sisters, to the little country school at the crossroads close by. But whereas Abigail and Martha thought nothing of it, taking everything as a matter of course, the long trudge down the hill and the long climb back again, the noise of the school sessions, and the still greater noise of the play hours, Mary seemed to wilt under it. So much so that on the advice of the old family doctor, Nathaniel Ladd of Pembroke, she was ultimately kept at home most of the time, and depended for her education upon what she could learn for herself with the aid of her mother and Albert. Albert was her great resort and standby. In those days, Dartmouth, like most other colleges, aimed at giving its students what used to be called in England a gentleman's education. The specializing of today was unknown, and before he graduated, the student had to be well grounded in the classics, mathematics, physics, rhetoric, and mental and moral philosophy. The college year was a long one, at any rate for the faculty. Instead of terminating as now in June, it went on into August, an arrangement which enabled students who needed to do so to take 2 or 3 months off during the winter to teach in the country schools at home or elsewhere. To the student who needed to work his way through college or to supplement an insufficient allowance, this was a great boon, and it was probably on such vacations as these that Albert and his small sister studied together, as she has recorded in her book, Retrospection and Introspection. Summing up the matter, she writes, "My father was taught to believe that my brain was too large for my body, and so kept me much out of school. But I gained book knowledge with far less labor than is usually requisite." And then she goes on to tell how that at the age of 10, she was as familiar with Lindley Murray's grammar as with the Westminster Catechism, and the latter I had to repeat every Sunday. Her favorite studies with Albert, she tells us, were natural philosophy, logic, and moral science, while she also received lessons in the ancient tongues, Hebrew, Greek, and Latin. It seems a formidable order indeed, but on the other hand, exactly the kind of education one would expect an eager child to get from an undergraduate brother whose thought was necessarily entirely occupied with just such studies. It need not be supposed that any of it was very deep or very thorough, but combined with the Westminster Catechism and the sonorous 18th century literature of Lindley Murray's grammar, it helped to lay a sure foundation for that precise style which was to be characteristic of Mrs. Eddy's writing all her life. Lindley Murray's grammar, if thoroughly studied, as books were studied in those days, read and reread and read again, was a liberal education in itself, especially when combined with the English reader. Mary had both books, and her original copies, much worn and copiously annotated, are still preserved. They are strangely revealing, for although they were in possession all her life, and might have been annotated at any time, still the character of the handwriting in these notes shows clearly enough the little girl in her teens. The English Reader, first published in America in Alexandria, Virginia, about 1810, is truly grand in its sweep and in the catholicity of its taste. The grammar, which was the standard textbook for 50 years throughout England and America, is excellent, but the reader is just grand. In the 400 or so pages which comprise the two books, Lindley Murray, in the seclusion of his Yorkshire home, managed to secure a truly remarkable selection of all that is best in 18th century literature. Goldsmith, Addison, Pope, Hume, Cowper, Samuel Johnson, to mention only a few at random, have liberal scope, while the Bible, especially the Book of Proverbs, and the ancient classics are well represented. With the help of Lindley Murray, the little girl learned that there were such people as Socrates and Sallust, Cicero and Marcus Aurelius, and read a few of the things they said. Lindley Murray was, moreover, much interested in questions of the day. As a lawyer in New York, before he determined to retire and make his home in England, he had been brought in contact with the rising question of slavery. When he reached England, he found Wilberforce thundering against the practice in the British colonies. And so into his reader went several articles on the subject, and poems by Cowper and Addison. That was some 15 years before the Missouri Compromise of 1820, whereby slavery was made a kind of local option in the United States. 15 years after the compromise, with Lloyd Garrison in turn fulminating against slavery in his abolitionist paper, The Liberator, in Boston, Mary Baker, in the farmhouse at Bow, was reading her Lindley Murray, marking the verses by Cowper and Addison, carefully studying the articles, and evidently being specially impressed with the paragraph which runs, "It may not be improper to remind the young reader that the anguish of the unhappy Negroes on being separated from their country and dearest connections, with the dreadful prospect of perpetual slavery, frequently becomes so exquisite as to produce derangement of mind and suicide." The extracts from the Bible, if one is to judge by the markings, were studied with special care. This verse from Proverbs has a mark and a number all its own. "Happy is the man that findeth wisdom. Length of days is in her right hand, and in her left hand riches and honor. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace." And so, as the little girl studied with her mother and Albert, Lindley Murray was a great help. Books, moreover, were only a small part of her means to the desired end. There were the 101 things she could read, mark, and learn every day in the life around her. Very early, she seems to have developed an aptitude for learning from the most unpromising things and circumstances, which was so characteristic in her later life. As soon as she could read at all, she read the newspapers. The New Hampshire Patriot and State Gazette came regularly to the house. And in the early 30s of last century, the New Hampshire Patriot and State Gazette, like all other papers in America, was full of the great question of slavery and how best it might be dealt with. That she read all about it and much else besides is perhaps sufficiently attested by the family record that when her father had settled down to read the family paper at night, she would, on occasion, steal downstairs in her nightgown and inveigle him into letting her read the papers to him. In spite of her occasional difficulty with long words, Mark seems to have suffered her gladly. In this matter of education, Mary Baker was a typical New Englander of that generation. With the greater part of their own young lives spent amidst wars and rumors of wars, in blazing new trails and clearing new lands, the New Englanders of the Revolutionary period had little time or opportunity for education. Education, however, was part of their heritage. Living in a less troubled period, their fathers and mothers had it more than they. And so, when more settled times came again, the Mark Bakers and Benjamin Pierces of New England determined that whenever possible, and wherever their children were ready to accept it, they should be given a good education. They wanted a good groundwork for all their children. But if any one of them should show any special ability and reveal the possibility of becoming a scholar, that was the fulfilling of a great desire, and he was afforded every opportunity. The achievements of Franklin on the one hand and the promise of Albert on the other were a great bond of union between the two fathers. And Mary's quiet insistence that she must learn things like Mr. Pierce, Mark evidently found hard to gainsay. It was about this time that an arrangement was come to between the two families, which was to bring them still more closely together. To Mary especially, it meant new daydreams for her two heroes. A case had come up for decision in the courthouse at Concord involving the townships of Bow and Loudon, a small town some 4 or 5 miles at the other side of the state capital from Bow, concerning a question of pauperism. The case for Loudon was pleaded by young Franklin Pierce, that for Bow by Mark Baker, and Mark Baker won. There is no record as to the rights of either party. It is possible that Loudon had such a bad case that Bow could not have lost, no matter who had conducted the case. But the outcome appealed to the sporting instincts of old General Pierce with a special keenness. He lost no time in driving over to Bow to congratulate his old friend and to enjoy with him the thought that the young people did not have it all their own way after all. The story is one that finds a place in many records and shows how the two men seem to have vied with each other in generosity, Squire Pierce maintaining that Squire Baker was the hero, a man who, without benefit of law learning of any kind, could go into open court and win his case against a man specially equipped, as was his son Franklin. Squire Baker, in return, dilated upon young Pierce's generosity, telling how he had come up to him after the trial and swept him a bow, and congratulated him with all his heart. And then, so the story goes, Squire Pierce, not to be outdone, began to talk about Albert, and how full of promise he thought the lad, and how they had been glad to welcome him into their home at Hillsboro, and how he would go far, and Mark should get him into politics, and how Franklin, who was a good Democrat, would be glad to show him the way. In fact, after he left college, what Albert should do was to come over to Hillsboro and get to reading law in Franklin's office. And so it was virtually settled, and seems from that time to have been taken for granted by the family at Bow as one of the happy developments that might be looked forward to in the future. Whether Mary actually overheard the conversation which settled the question, as she did so many, it is not possible to say, but it is evident from her subsequent references to the matter that the plan filled her with deep satisfaction. Her first letters, which began to appear about this time, show how eagerly, if sometimes a little self-consciously, she welcomes any and every opportunity to learn, both for herself and others. A letter she wrote at this period, or a little later, to her brother Sullivan, makes this clear enough. She thanks a dear brother for friendly advice and counsel, and for lively interest in my welfare. Tells him how much she misses his help and encouragement. Chides herself with the reflection that there is no philosophy in repining, and begs in conclusion that he will excuse all mistakes. But it was not only absent brothers. Samuel had by this time gone to Boston to learn the building business, and Albert was at Dartmouth, that tempted repining. The burden of ill health, which Mary was to carry through so many weary years, began even then to press hard upon her. What exactly was the nature of this ill health, or its cause, is not easy to determine. It was nothing that Dr. Nathaniel Ladd could give a definite name to. At best, he could only observe the things and circumstances, especially the circumstances, that seemed to make the child better or worse. Some of it was simple enough. When he found that the rough and tumble of the country school was evidently too much for her, he advised that she be kept at home as much as possible. When he found that Mark was launching one of his grand crusades to rescue a soul from the burning, with his small daughter as the objective, he could put his foot down and insist that it stop. But there were other things not so clear, and even Dr. Ladd found it hard to believe that the theoretical sufferings or inconveniences of animals, or such abstruse and faraway questions as unconditional election, could have a serious effect on the little girl's health. And yet, somehow, they seemed to be conjoined to operate as cause and effect. At first, it was no more than a low fever at times, long restless nights, alternating with radiant joy and complete freedom. Later on, it took physical shape in some form of indigestion, until at the age of about 14, we find a passage in a letter to her brother Sullivan, which indicates clearly enough that the long struggle had begun. "I must," she writes, the phraseology is typical, Extend the thought of benevolence further than selfishness would permit, and only add my health at present is improving slowly, and I hope by dieting and being careful to sometime regain it.